I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, a deep dive crime podcast which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen.
Let's kick off with the details of this case. We'll go back to late June 2023. 911 get an anonymous call from a disconnected cell phone telling them that there is a dead body of a little girl inside an apartment at the Hidden Valley apartment complex on Misty Waters Drive.
It's a dead body of a little girl in building 2815, apartment 27. Can y'all please hurry up?
Okay, what's the address there?
Apartment 27. Looks like she's been there for like at least 6-7 months.
Now, a guy has made this call after he apparently came across the apartment around 4 p.m, saw the door wide open, gets closer, tries to observe what's going on there, just recognises that there's something out of place as far as he's concerned, and he notices what he described as an awful stench. So he goes in to investigate. He finds that the lights are off, all the furniture's in place, but there are objects just strewn about the countertops. It's as if somebody's left in a hurry. Then he notices another open door, and at this point, horrifically, he recognises a human arm hanging out of the closet. Now, you can't even begin to compute how you're going to feel or react in that circumstance, but he does the right thing. Yeah, he freezes for a moment, takes in the scene, recognises that he is dealing with the worst sight ever, and then he rings 911. He tells the operator that it looks like she's been there for 6 or 7 months. Now, the man who made the call later says, she looks like a real mummy, but you could tell it was a young girl, according to him, because of what she had on and also by her hair. So this is an absolutely horrific scene to greet this individual. And even though he calls it in, it's not going to go as we would imagine in the first instance, because officers from the DeKalb Police Department, they arrive at the reported apartment, they knock on the door, just going to throw it out there. Just going to suggest that if a dead body has been found in an apartment and a stranger has gone in and seen that no one's there, knocking on the door probably isn't going to get you any response whatsoever, bearing in mind no one is at the property and the individual who is in there is dead and, according to the caller, in a mummified state. No one answers. They then let themselves in. It is messy inside. They do agree with that. There's furniture and children's toys just all over the place, so clearly evident that there have been children there at some point. And yet, upon that search, they don't find anything suspicious. How is this possible? How is it possible that police officers go in to a home that somebody's reported there is a dead body in and they don't find anything suspicious, even though apparently there is a, quote, funky smell? One of the officers is literally heard saying, but it doesn't smell like 49 funk, which apparently is code for deceased person. So the officers leave the scene, which is just bizarre because clearly there is an individual who is mummified in that property that has been called in by that man who found them. Now, over the next 2 days, the man who initially reported finding the body of this dead child makes more calls to 911, still very concerned, still pleading for them to go back and investigate. And it is bizarre to me that initially that falls on deaf ears. Now, we get to June the 25th. Then that same man, who by this point must be both frustrated and exasperated and also thinking, why do law enforcement exist? I'm literally calling in about the body of a dead child being found by me and they're ignoring me. He finally gets in touch with the security guard. That security guard then contacts 911 himself. So the officers eventually go back down to that scene. So they search the apartments, and it's during this search they do find that little girl's body. So the officer observes the young child's arm in the closet, and then when he looks closer, he sees that the child's body is actually sat in a stroller and appeared to be mummified. Now, when investigators and pathologists look at the actual body and describe it as mummified, the way that they're describing it is simply meaning that the soft tissue's dried out and become kind of leathery or hard, so it's not decomposed in the usual way that we'd expect. So it's more like a natural process that occurs when decomposition fluids evaporate faster than bacteria can break down the tissue. So that shows that basically she hadn't just recently died. She'd been left unattended for an extended period. So long enough, basically, for her body to completely dry out. So investigators can therefore conclude that she likely died slowly from neglect and starvation, and also that she'd been there for months, which is a horrendous reality, that a child could be left in such a terrible state, could be murdered, in my opinion, very slowly, and to go through the trauma of being neglected, feeling neglected, and then slowly going through that process of dying over a period of time. Now, as the officer gets closer after he's discovered the arm and seen that there is a body of this child in the stroller, he sees that, according to his assumption, the child looks around 6 years of age. He could tell that she was a girl because he could see her hair, which seemed to be in a ponytail. And he also noted that the top half of the child was folded down towards her knees, looking as if she was falling out of the stroller. They could also tell that she was wearing a red tank top with a black comforter covering her bottom half. They could also tell she was wearing a soiled diaper. There was a red purse on her as well. There was apparently a minimal smell of decomposition, even though her remains were in an advanced state of decomposition. But the investigators could also see evidence of dead maggots and flies, which were apparently too numerous to count, but there weren't any that were alive. So at this point, the officers begin a more thorough sweep of the house than the last time. At this point, they find a prescription receipt to 27-year-old Alondra Denise Hobbs. They also notice photos on the walls of pictures of a newborn baby, but they didn't actually have dates on, so they were unsure how old the photos were. They also noticed that there were blankets and clothes placed at the bottom of the front door and the bedroom door. And that's obviously because the person is trying to prevent the smell from escaping. So somebody knows there is a dead child in this home and they want other people to be unaware of it. Yes, they know the child is dead, but they certainly don't want anyone else to know that child is dead. They also noticed that the size of the shoes they find in the home was smaller than the size of the shoe of the deceased child, which means that there were likely more children in that home at some point. They note when they search around the home that there are items which you would use to do children's hair, such as hair ties, but the child who's dead in the stroller, their hair was in a simple ponytail, which they described as a small puff. So again, evidencing that there's potentially other children that's been at that property. Lurking around, it is just full of items of disarray. There's trash, there's bugs, there's mess. But all the beds and belongings still seem to be inside the apartment. It's almost as if somebody has just grabbed essential items and left in a hurry, but not packed and prepared for a normal house move. Now, when the medical examiner arrives at the scene to collect the body, one of the things that they notice is this black fabric around the child's thigh, and that fabric would have acted as a restraint. So this fabric was basically the buckle of her stroller, and it had been fastened with the strap between her legs. So as we know, this is what keeps our child from falling out of the stroller, particularly as they're getting bigger. Also, they found a piece of fabric near her mouth. When he checked inside the red purse, he found an ID card, and that also belonged to Alondra Hobbs. That's the same name as on the prescription receipt. Now, the property owner, when they speak to them, tells the investigators that Alondra Hobbs was living there, but at the time, she'd been under eviction for not paying rent. They also tell the investigators that her partner, Cameron Hobbs, had come down to the apartment about 2 weeks before and asked to be taken off the lease. But apparently neighbours believe that the couple had gathered the belongings and left around 3 to 4 months before that particular event. Now, a BOLO at this point is put out for Hobbs. That's a be on the lookout, because clearly they want to bring this woman in for questioning. And then investigators go ahead and speak to the Department of Children and Families. And they learn at this point that Hobbs had 3 daughters, 1 aged 2, 1 aged 4, and 1 aged 7. Now, the 4-year-old is her ex-partner Cameron Hobbs' child and apparently is in his care. They also go ahead and they contact Hobbs' mother. She tells them that the 2-year-old is safe and she'd actually seen her recently, but then tells them some really worrying information. She says she hasn't actually seen the 7-year-old child, Olivia Naomi Jordan, since the year before. It almost blows my mind every time I come across those kind of statements. The idea that you can have a relationship to some degree with children in a family who are, for example, your grandchildren, and you can be aware that one of them is okay, or maybe two of them are okay, but you don't know where the third one is, and you haven't actually seen or heard from them in a year. It just is breathtaking in nature. Why do people not have an awareness of biologically related children in their lives? You know, grandchildren are so close to the average grandparents, and yet here we have a child that hasn't even been seen for a year, and no one has done anything about tracing where they are or finding out whether they're okay. She's 7. You should absolutely know where your grandchild is. And I know that sounds blameful. It's meant to. If we're not protecting our nearest and dearest, what are we doing? Now, Olivia's medical profile is one of the firmly documented aspects of her incredibly short life. So she was autistic, and medical records showed that she suffered from seizures related to cerebral palsy. Records from the DA's office actually state that Olivia was not enrolled in school at the time of her death. So a global study actually found that overall about 1/3 of children with disabilities have experienced some form of violence, and neglect is the most common form of maltreatment among disabled children. And this comes down to a range of reasons. So they often rely on a number of adults for daily activities, including intimate personal care. That can increase exposure. It can also blur physical boundaries. Then you have communication difficulties. So speech, language and communication needs can make it difficult for children to tell others what's happening to them or who's hurting them. You often have a level of social isolation. So disabled children often have fewer contacts outside the family. That limits opportunities for other adults to notice signs of abuse. Then there's the impaired capacity when it comes down to being able to avoid abuse to some degree. Not that typical kids who are abused can resist or avoid abuse on the whole, but it just makes it even more difficult when it comes down to not understanding what appropriate behaviour is. So a typical child might realise that somebody's doing something inappropriate and seek help. A disabled child often is limited to doing that. Then there's that classic fear of not being believed. They feel like disclosing their abuse or complaining about the abuse will mean that they lose essential services or help, or they might be seen as an unreliable witness. All of these things coincide with why kids don't actually get the help that they deserve. And certainly when it comes down to children who are physically disabled, things like bruising or behavioural changes can sometimes be wrongly attributed to the child's disability. And that means that there's missed opportunities where intervention can actually occur. And finally, I suppose one of the big things is that abusers target disabled kids. They think they're less likely to get detected, the child won't be able to give credible evidence, and all of that colludes to a situation where disabled children are the most vulnerable. Now, family members said that Olivia was typically kept neatly groomed. They said that she always had neatly combed hair. But again, I cannot tell you how frustrating it is when people look at a child and go, oh, they present neatly, therefore they must be well. Often we don't see what is beneath the clothing, and perpetrators know how to mask their abuse by doing things like making sure they are neatly groomed. Relatives had been told the story, apparently, that Olivia was staying with paternal relatives in Albany, Georgia. This is what, according to them, shaped their understanding of where she was in the months before the police made the discovery. But again, why would you not want to keep in contact with a child that's meant to be close to you? Why would you not want to have it confirmed by having FaceTime calls or occasional conversations with them? No matter where they live, you still have access to them through that kind of technology. And no matter how disabled they may be, you can still have communication with them to some degree. Now, according to the evidence that I've managed to find, her mother had 2 prior arrests in DeKalb County before 2023. So in August 2019, she was arrested for simple assault. And in May 2020, she was arrested for battery and family violence, which is deeply concerning because she obviously has had 3 children within her care. Now, there's no public confirmation that DFCS had prior involvement with Olivia or Hobbs before the homicide. And neither the DA's press release nor local coverage mentions an open case, prior hotline calls, safety plans or removal. So there's nothing that kind of intrinsically links child services to this particular case. But again, children who are not attending school, children who are not being supported by services, children who've been basically taken into the shadows by primary caregivers are often the most vulnerable. But I personally believe that services should have been involved in this case, because if she's been removed from school, if she has complex disabilities, surely there should be somebody following up her care and making sure that she's being taken care of appropriately, particularly when you think about the fact that the mother has got prior violent issues around her behaviour to family members. That, to me, speaks of a failure in that kind of wraparound care that we should expect for children of this nature. Now, on June the 28th, the DeKalb County Medical Examiner's Office confirmed that the remains were indeed those of 7-year-old Olivia Jordan. This is after DNA testing and dental record comparisons have been made. The police publicly identified the victim as Alondra Hobbs' daughter, and they, at this point, reclassified the case as a homicide. Now, following this confirmation, detectives were able to obtain an arrest warrant for Alondra Hobbs. The medical examiners also stated that when they did the autopsy, there were no organs left inside her body due to decomposition. That is why the child was indeed in that state of mummification. Also, bizarrely, they found a plastic grocery bag that had been folded up to approximately 4 by 4 square inches, and that was found in her abdominal cavity. There was also plastic found in some remaining fecal material. I haven't been able to find any information that suggests why. I do know that when it came down to her unclothed body's weight, she weighed 5 pounds. That makes literally no sense to me, and is deeply disturbing on every single level. There was actually no evidence of any fractures or soft tissue calcification. So her cause of death was listed as inanition and also dehydration. So inanition is a state of extreme exhaustion and weakness caused by a lack of nourishment, which can include physical starvation. We're talking about a 7-year-old child. Imagine the absolute torture that little girl went through. And we're talking about a child with additional needs. It is incomprehensible to me the evil involved in allowing that child to wither and die. Now, investigators believe the plausible abandonment window was between the 28th of February 2023 until the 25th of June 2023. So they believe that she was just abandoned and left for around 4 months, which is just devastating to even conceive of. A 7-year-old child just left to die and then dismissed for that period of time. Now, on June the 29th, which is a day after her arrest warrant is given, law enforcement locate Hobbs staying in Georgia with her then 2-year-old daughter. So at this point, she's arrested on felony murder and second degree cruelty to children. Reports state that she was initially under hospital care, and then after this period of time, she's transferred to jail upon discharge. Now, when they bring her in for questioning, she basically begins by explaining that she has a 2-year-old, an 8-year-old, and a 4-year-old. She says that she doesn't see all of them, as the father of one of the children, who is named Cameron Hobbs, won't let her apparently see this child. He doesn't answer phone calls, he doesn't answer texts from her. She also says she hasn't seen Olivia in a while, just the 2-year-old who was with her when she's arrested. Just going to throw it out there. It's not going to cut it with anyone, is it? So where's your child? Oh, I don't know. With the dad, not allowed to see them. But where are they? I don't know. I just don't care. I'm just kind of not really invited or invested or involved in this actual life, so I don't bother about it. I just get on with my own life because I'm a massively egocentric narcissist. So basically, she just hadn't seen Olivia in a while, you know, like the average mother has. You know, how many children have you got? I've got 3 children. Oh, that's nice. How old are they? 2, 4, and around 7 or 8. I'm not necessarily quite sure about the absolute age. That's unusual. I would imagine you know the age of your child. Well, 7 or 8, you know, I think 8, but it might turn out that she was 7. So, do you have a great relationship with them all? Yeah. Well, I mean, I say I have a great relationship with them all, you know, when I see them. How often do you see them? Well, I see my 2-year-old. And yeah, and the other ones with the father, and I don't really know where the older one is. I'm not even that sure of her age, if I'm completely honest. You're a terrible human being. I'm just gonna say that at the end of the day, I was overwhelmed. Honestly, Sorry, it drives me absolutely bonkers. It drives me bonkers. Because you know what? People have problems, I get it. Not everybody is cut out to be a mother, for example, and I take absolute joy in the knowledge that some people are brave enough to give their children up. I genuinely mean that. Because life isn't in a good state for them and they don't feel necessarily at times naturally inclined to be a primary caregiver. They have problems with dependency. There are lots of reasons why people give their children up. Even when they absolutely adore those kids, they will do it for the benefit of the child. But there are a group of people who just shouldn't be parents. And this woman is fitting into that category just by her statements at this stage. Who doesn't know where their kids are? Even if you are not actually residing with them, why would you not know where your children were? And also, how could you even let those words come off your tongue? I really mean that. How would you be okay just saying, oh, I don't really know where one of them is? She basically said, I left Olivia with Cameron because it was a lot. It was a lot. It was just so much. It was a lot. And because this child is autistic, she couldn't basically deal with it. Now, again, I have absolute sympathy and absolute empathy with parents of disabled children, with parents of children with complex needs. First of all, I think that they are exponentially stressed because they don't get the support that they deserve. And it's wrong. You know, they provide incredible care for children with these great complex needs. I also see that they are unbelievably loving, compassionate, empathetic, sympathetic, and they care about their child above the needs that they have for themselves. That's the average parent of a child with these kind of needs. But what we are seeing here is a mother who is so disconnected from the needs of a child and is so connected to her own needs that she can literally say, oh, it was a lot. She was autistic. What else could I do but abandon and neglect her? She also states that the day that she left Olivia, she went out on a date with a man who she'd met through an app. I mean, the very fact that you're even giving that information speaks volumes, doesn't it? They're interviewing you about the death of your girl, the death of your child. And you're going, oh, well, there was a reason that I left her. She was just too much for me and I had a date. Need to go and hang out with a guy called Ty. And when you think about priorities, obviously looking after your child with complex needs versus going and hanging out with a stranger, obviously hanging out with a stranger is going to be the one you go for every single time. She also says that Cameron wanted to give the child away to white folks. Genuinely. This woman is literally grasping at straws, isn't she? So Cameron Hobbs, the father in this case, or at least the father to one of the children in this case, yeah, he was just clearly going, you know, just give her away to white folks. Just go ahead. It just seems like a completely normal practice. Just hand them over to those white folks. I mean, come on. She also said that Cameron was somebody who beat her, and that he would beat her so badly that he would throw her in the closet. So he's basically being painted as the individual who is incredibly violent towards the child and the threat to the child. She also said that he would pull out the child's hair, but the investigators just don't believe her claims. All the evidence suggests, in fact, that she was the last one to be looking after Olivia. Now, Cameron Hobbs, understandably, is brought in because there's accusations been levied at him, and also he'll have information about what's happened in that home at some point. And he comes into the station along with one of the other daughters, the four-year-old. So he explains that he is the biological father to one of the three girls. He had nothing to do with the birth of Olivia. She was born before his relationship with Hobbs. He hasn't seen Olivia or the other child in over a year. Now, that makes far more sense. He's the biological father of one of the children, and he is with that biological child. Now, this is obviously inconsistent with the story that Hobbs is stating, because she's been saying that Cameron was in charge of Olivia as well, which would be very unusual. Why would he be looking after a non-biological child? Makes no sense at all. Now, they bring the four-year-old into a private room to basically speak with a specialist. And during this conversation with this four-year-old child, she's making some really concerning comments. So when she's asked about her dad, she says things like, he killed me, he make it bleed, he did the last one too. She's also talking about how her mother gives her a whooping. And at one point, the investigator asks about her family members, and she describes Olivia as being angry, But then a minute later, she starts saying skeleton, skeleton, and skeleton in the dark. When she's asked who the skeleton is,
now, bear in mind, this child is four.
Her understanding of the world around her is going to be minimal compared to how she'll be at 10. But they're just trying to ease out any information that could be pivotal to this case, or at least contribute to an understanding of the wider family. Obviously, we don't know exactly what she's seen, and because of her age, the information and her name personally is actually redacted from the legal files, as it should be. She should be granted anonymity. Now, after more questioning in the interrogation room, Hobbs basically comes out eventually with the truth. She tells them that she left Alivia in that closet because she was too much. Simple as that. She literally says that she put Alivia in that closet, left her in that closet because she was too much. She also says to the investigators that Olivia was alive when she left her. She also suggests that she left food and water for her before she left. But firstly, there's no evidence of this. And secondly, is it an everlasting pot of food and water? Of course it's not. It doesn't matter if you leave a week's worth of food and water. If you're gone for 4 months, the outcome is assured. The child is not going to survive. And it's so brutal to imagine this mother, this person who birthed this child, who brought this baby into the world, literally placing her in a stroller, parking her in the closet, closing the door, going on a date, and never coming back. If there's a description of evil, I just described it. Because yeah, we can talk about the cases where children are battered and broken and killed in an event that is just unspeakably evil. But this mother walked away to leave that child to be brutally tortured by facing absolute starvation and dehydration, to sit in their own waste as they withered away. She did that knowingly. She did that without any doubt of the outcome. Anybody knows, if you leave a child unaccompanied, with no food and no water, they're not going to make out alive. And she just did that and got about her business, as if this child was nothing, a disposable piece of rubbish that can just rot away in a closet. Now, of course, the investigators know that even if she had left some food and water there, which is unlikely she did, the reality is this child is disabled and she'd been strapped into the stroller and that buckled in her bottom half, which means that she was restrained. Now, bear in mind, Hobbs has explained that her child had the mind of a two-year-old, she doesn't have a lot of strength, so that clearly means that the investigators don't find it difficult to work out that due to her cerebral palsy, she would have been unable to unbuckle herself, she would have been unable to get out of the closet, therefore she was just left to starve there. She also, at this point, denies having put the blankets and clothes underneath the doors, also denied covering the body with anything, which makes no sense whatsoever. Of course, she left the blankets there to cover the stench. She was the one who chose to leave the child in that situation. She didn't want to get caught. She doesn't know what to do. She's got a dead body. So she's doing her best to disguise the situation. Now, at one point, she actually mentions how she doesn't have an ID because apparently her brother stole it along with a bunch of her items. Now, investigators do actually confirm this is a true report. It was made by her back in March. The report states they got into a verbal altercation over groceries being brought into the house. He allegedly started consuming the groceries that she bought. This escalated into him pushing her into a wall, choking her, and allegedly threatening to kill her. He apparently pointed a handgun at her and then stole multiple items. He took 2 iPhones, IDs, debit cards. She also claims that he stole the keys to the apartment, which is really strange because he was never actually charged in relation to this. And police found absolutely no forensic evidence of his entry. Some people do believe he did this and they believe that he was actually the anonymous caller and that he did that to set her up and to get her caught. But again, the anonymous caller's identity remains officially unconfirmed. But it would make sense that if he has got into that apartment to have a look around because he had taken her items, and bear in mind her ID was found in that apartment, so it would actually add up, that if he comes across that child, automatically he's going to think, I need the authorities to be aware of what's happened, but equally, I don't want to implicate myself in a case where I could get into trouble for stealing from my sister. Now, when she's asked if she ever thought to go back to help Olivia or to check on her, she literally says, "I mean, it ran across my head, but I wasn't in the right mental state at the time." Could you be any more self-centered? Is it possible to have an award for self-centeredness? If so, can we give her the award? Because she has absolutely reached the pivotal point of, I have no concerns about any other human being apart from myself. And I'm so tired when people say, oh, I wasn't in the right mental state. Listen, lots of people are out there, like a huge amount of people are out there with serious mental health conditions, with serious mental illnesses. And you know what they are? They're really good, nice people who would not harm the hair on the head of anybody. In fact, often they bend and break themselves to please other people. Stop bringing in, oh, I had issues with my own mental health at the time, so I couldn't go and retrieve my child from a closet where she was starving to death. Please, please cry me a river about what's going on in your life, because let me tell you, whatever your mental state was, it was nothing like the mental state of your child, who apparently had the mental age of a two-year-old strapped in a stroller, starving to death slowly. It's disgusting that she thinks there is any point of excuse when it comes down to this case. Now, they also are armed with Facebook posts that she'd made in April that year. And on one of these posts, she wrote, "I'm in the worst pain of my life right now. I'm going through a lot. So I need my prayer warriors to keep me uplifted in their prayers, please and thank you. I'm not doing so good." And then another post 2 days before that wrote this, "The worst day of my life. Keep me in your prayers because I'm not okay." Now, was this because she was guilty over the fact that she'd abandoned her daughter? Was this because she realised the error of her ways? Was this because she was thinking to herself, please God, let this child be okay. Let a miracle have occurred so that I don't have to face the consequences of my brutal actions. No, it wasn't. It was because she'd been cheated on by a guy she had been dating. I mean, when it comes down to the list of priorities in your life, when it comes down to thinking about the worst day of your life, let's just think about it. My innocent, beautiful child being starved to death versus a guy cheating on me. My child being brutalized in the most horrendous of ways, tortured and left alone for months so her body could mummify. Is that worse than the guy I'm not really involved in, but I've kind of been seeing a bit, cheating on me? A or B? A or B? I'm going to go with the guy cheating on me. I mean, literally, that tells you how narcissistic this woman is. When you think about narcissism, you think about the true definition of it, you're talking about an individual who is so consumed by their own needs, who has so little care or compassion about other human beings that as long as they're getting fed with whatever they want, they are okay. But the minute that somebody requires anything from them, they are gone. Because all they care about is themselves. Now, the police also ask her whether she wanted Olivia to have a funeral. She responds this.
"Do you want Olivia to be buried and have like closure for her body? Do you want her?
I mean,
do you want
a funeral? Funeral?
Yeah, do you want a funeral for her?
No, because nobody really dealt with her like that. Nobody helped me out with her, no."
What? Nobody really dealt with her like, do you want a funeral for your child? No. No, because you know, at the end of the day, nobody really dealt with her like that. Yeah, I don't think that we generally deal with funerals of children. Yeah, I'm just saying that nobody really dealt with her like that. Are you saying that nobody cared for her? Basically, I mean, who would care for that child? That's maybe the mindset that she has, because that's how it comes across to me, that she didn't care about this kid. So why would anybody else actually care enough to want to go through the ritual of that funeral to mark the worth of this child's life, the mark that says this child mattered? But it didn't matter to this woman, to this mother, this person who was blessed with this baby. Yes, this baby had complex needs. Yes, we all appreciate the stress that brings. Yes, we understand the challenges that that presents. But my God, there are support networks for those people if they don't want to take care of that child anymore. You can literally hand the child over to people who will care for them. But no, apparently the care for this child is so negligible that when she is posed the question, would you like a funeral for them? She doesn't even want to warrant that. She doesn't reach the bar of requiring that. Now, at this point, she also talks about the fact that she's had suicidal ideation, and if she hadn't done what she did, she would have had to kill herself. So again, how egocentric. Look, I'm not suggesting that she should have killed herself. Of course I'm not. You all know how connected I am to personally experiencing suicide where my father's suicide is concerned. But what I am saying is, when it comes down to somebody with suicidal ideation, it doesn't come down to, well, it's me or my child. It doesn't come down to, well, I'll kill them versus I'll kill myself. That isn't a choice that needs to be made. You can both survive. You don't even have to take care of your child anymore. Hand your child over and then go and get the help and support that you require. But instead, she's saying, look, I had to make a sacrifice and I chose to sacrifice my child. And again, that goes against natural order. It goes against natural instinct. It goes against everything we understand about mothers and children. Of course, you choose your child over yourself. It's as simple as that. Now, Cameron Hobbs's mother, she also comes down to the station and they want to talk about the wider implications of this case. What were the kids that she had contact with who were also Hobbs's children like? And she said that Alondra's kids were always dirty, that she beat them, they were always injured. She actually showed officers photos of Olivia's bruised chest that she'd taken on a visit in the past. And she also claimed that she actually used to take her back to her house just to make sure that she was clean. It does beg the question, why didn't you report to child services? It does beg the question, why did you not do a little bit more? Look, I appreciate the grandma in this case is not directly connected to her because this is Cameron's mother. But nonetheless, I think that you should absolutely go out of your way to insist that some kind of investigation goes on if you're seeing a child being damaged by a primary caregiver and you have evidence of that damage. Now, as the investigation progressed, neighbours end up telling reporters that one other thing about Hobbs is that she always kept herself to herself. She rarely let anyone into the apartment. And when it came down to the child, she was rarely seen outside or at school. One neighbour actually described that one of the things that Hobbs, they could confirm, would often say, was that she was suicidal. So that suicidal ideation she's talking about to the police does seem to be consistent with prior behaviour. But nonetheless, like I said, in this case, she's suggesting that it was a case of her or the child surviving, which makes no sense whatsoever. Now, that same neighbour who'd recalled those suicidal tendencies of Hobbs said that they had seen Olivia a few times, but then her mother began offering an excuse for her absence. So this neighbour said she used to tell us that other people got her, like the daddy side or her family. She'd be like, the daddy side of the family have her. So they're just saying that she basically made excuses for why she wasn't around anymore. And even though I always think that we should be really hyper-vigilant when children just disappear, I can completely conceive that that's a reality for the neighbours. You don't think that there is anything monstrous about somebody who lives in your area on the whole. If they say, ah, oh, yeah, she's no longer present, she's gone to stay with her biological father, often people are quite satisfied with that excuse. Now, Olivia's aunt, Latrice Robinson, she said, we had no clue. The baby was supposed to be with the dad's mum in Albany. That's what she kept telling us.
She was supposed to be with the daddy's mom at her dad's mom house. That's where Olivia was supposed to be. Olivia wasn't supposed to be in no closet.
Now, another thing that investigators learned through transactional records after Olivia's death is that Hobbs had continued to collect $900 a month in disability benefits for her daughter. So I don't want to be bothered with my daughter because, you know, it's just too much. It's all too much. But I would definitely like all of the disability payments that I get for my daughter. So basically, your daughter's too much, but the money is certainly not too much. Oh, no, I'd like there to be more money from my daughter, really. So ideally, I could get $1,800 a month. That'd be even more fantastic. But yeah, I don't want anything to do with the actual care of my child. No, she can wither away and die, but I'll just be taking the money and going on my dates and moaning on Facebook that my life isn't good enough because at the end of the day, guys, cheat on me. Ugh. Now, the other two children at this point were rightfully taken into custody of DCF because they're going to be cared for there. There are obviously issues that have come up in the interview with the four-year-old about the father's care of that four-year-old. And we know that Hobbs is completely unsafe to be around children and is now in custody. So that obviously has to take place. Now, by the 5th of July, this is about a week after her arrest, Hobbs makes her first appearance via Zoom in court. Now, due to the charge severity, at this point, the case is bound over to the Superior Court, so she remained rightfully in custody pending Superior Court action. Now, through late 2023 into 2024, that case then proceeds into Superior Court while the investigators and prosecutors build up their evidence. Now, Hobbs's defence requested a competency evaluation, but she is indeed deemed competent to stand trial in 2024. Now, when it comes down to the prosecutor's argument, they emphasise how Hobbs left Olivia confined to a stroller in a closet sometime between February and June, and that she had no intention of returning. They also said that Olivia was alive when she was abandoned, or because life was, quote, too much. The state also argued how Hobbs showed little remorse, telling the court how she kept cashing Olivia's disability benefits and how she started dating immediately when she didn't have the responsibility of Olivia anymore. Also how she told investigators that being cheated on was the, quote, worst day of her life. So it just demonstrates the callousness of this woman.
She posted on Facebook that it was the worst day of her life. Police asked her during this interview what she meant by that, presuming that she was processing what she had done with her daughter. Her response, however, was that it was in reference to her boyfriend, George, who she found out was cheating on her.
The state also underscored that Olivia had autism and seizure disorder, which was related to cerebral palsy, and that that meant as well that the manner of death was a slow, painful and lonely process because of the confinement and because of the neglect. She was never going to leave that closet. It's as simple as that. Now, when it came down to defence, they had none. They should just have gone in with that. We rest our case, Honour. We have no defence whatsoever. She's indefensible. If we were going to defend anything, we'd be like, well, you have given us a case of having to defend the devil. And then we've realised that the devil cannot be defended. So we're just going to say, send the devil back to where the devil belongs. The big H-E-L-L. Amen. I rest my case. Anyway, the defence argue that the acceptance of responsibility must be looked at positively. So the fact that she was going, yes, I did do that, because obviously she did, because she actually goes, yes, I did, because all the evidence says she did, that is something that's going to mitigate some of the aggravating circumstances to some degree. The defence counsel told the court that Hobbs didn't want a trial, she didn't want to make excuses, and she wanted to take responsibility. But they asked the judge to impose life with the possibility of parole rather than without parole. So they're saying, you know, she said that she did it. She hasn't cost us money having a trial. Of course she hasn't, because she would have been found guilty anyway. But nonetheless, this is their argument, and they're basically asking for some leniency. Just give her a hope in the future of parole. Please, please, judge. Yeah, she's a horrific human being who tortured and brutalized a child by starving them to death in a closet, leaving them alone to face the uncertainty and then the realization and then the horror of their demise. But apart from that, you know, she's not a really terrible person. She did say she did it. Ugh. Maybe they should give her a Facebook post and see whether this is the worst day of her life. Just throwing it out there. On April the 23rd, 2025, Hobbs did enter a non-negotiated blind guilty plea to one count of malice murder, two counts of felony murder, and two counts of cruelty to children in the first degree. Judge Letitia Deer Jackson accepted the plea and immediately sentenced Hobbs to life without the possibility of parole. Amen to that.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to impose a sentence of a total sentence for the entire case to life without the possibility of parole. You'll be given credit for the 660 days that you have served, which is credit from the time that you were in custody.
So this, of course, ended the case without the need for a jury trial, but didn't give her what she wanted, which was one day to be faced with the possibility of parole. No, sweetheart, you are serving the rest of your life behind bars, and rightly so. And even then, you get so much more than you afforded your child. You get life. You get life. That's the irony when we say life without the possibility of parole, because it means you get to live. And yeah, prison is imperfect. And yeah, prison is not something that we would choose. But you know what? They get educated, they get fed, they don't have to worry about bills or responsibilities, they get a bed to lie in at night, they get friendships that they have with people. There are a whole heap of things that they are afforded that that beautiful little girl will not be afforded. Now, the judge actually reflected on the unusual nature of the murder. She said it doesn't involve a weapon. She described the facts as very tragic, incredibly difficult to process. I mean, that is to some degree an underestimation of the reality, but how do you describe this in court? How do you really talk about the demise and the withering of this little girl? It's almost impossible to find the words to describe the reality of the horror. Now, District Attorney Sherry Boston, they said Olivia Jordan did not deserve the slow, painful and lonely death she suffered at the hand of her mother. I hope the family takes some comfort in knowing Alondra Hobbs is being held accountable. We want parents to know that abandoning a child is never the right choice and help is available. Now, Hobbs did make a brief statement to the court saying she was sorry and that she couldn't handle it again. So insufficient. I couldn't handle it. Still about her. I'm the victim. I couldn't handle it. Where are you in this moment? Where are you in court when you have the opportunity to actually explain to people what a horrendous human being you are? But you know, to really get that, you have to have insight into your nature, and she clearly doesn't. She still somehow sees herself as being the victim, and she had no other option because she just couldn't handle it, as if there weren't another million options she could have taken. Now, Judge Letitia Dear Jackson noted the apology, but described it as limited and detached. Understatement of the century, but absolutely true. Now, when it's come down to the memory of Olivia, a fundraiser was created, a GoFundMe, in fact, titled Funeral Services for Olivia Hobbs Jordan. That was created by her grandmother, because unlike the mother in this case, her grandmother did think that she deserved a funeral. Obviously, they wanted some help with the funeral expenses, and the description reads, "Hello, my name is Tammy Blassingame, the grandmother of precious angel Olivia Hobbs Jordan. For starters, I want to thank the DeKalb County Sheriff's Department and detectives for all their help and support. I want to thank my family and friends for covering me during this disturbing and humane situation. Please continue praying for us while we process this horrific tragedy. Grandma's baby girl, a true gift from heaven. I love you so much. My sweet angel, protect and watch over us. I'm lost for words. I'm sorry she took you away from us. You had a wonderful future ahead of you. We will do everything in our power to get justice. We are forever saying your name. Hashtag long live Livy. Hashtag rest easy princess. Stop the violence, seek help and end child cruelty." There was a funeral service that was held on Saturday, December 16, 2023. That was held at 1 p.m. in Georgia. And the obituary for it reads like this. "She was a very happy and precious little girl with a huge smile that would light up the room. She loved to eat, was not picky about her food. She loved her toys. And no matter what the size, she always had a toy in her hand. Her favourite saying was, hey, y'all." Oh, it's so sad when you bring it down to those kind of words, you know. The obituary that is so small to describe a life that would have been so big. And I think sometimes you just hear these stories and see these words placed into these small sections of a newspaper or an article online, and it's hard for us to kind of wrap our heads around the enormity of what we're actually discussing. We're talking about the lack of a future. We're talking about a foundation betrayed. We're talking about a child with complex needs being tortured and brutalized in the most grotesque of ways. We're talking about a mother so incompetent that she thought that dating strangers was more important than caring for her child. We're talking about a million opportunities that could have saved that child that were all denied because one woman was so selfish and egocentric that she just closed the closet door and walked away. We're talking about maybe she could have got away with it had somebody not found that little girl in that situation and reported it. We're talking about all of those possibilities in one moment. It is staggering to me that still in a society that is so developed and so incredible in so many ways, still these kind of abuses take place under our very noses, in our neighbours' homes, in our community that we trust. They play out time and time again. There is always something really provoking about a child with special needs facing this kind of abuse, because you just know there is a silencing of their needs because of the complexities of their diagnosis. And that makes it even more pertinent that we learn to risk offending. We learn to speak out when we're concerned about the way a child is being treated. In this case, the grandmother knew that violence was happening in the home. We need to do more to give volume and amplification to these cases when we see things like this playing out in our neighborhoods, because these kind of horrendous tragedies occur. Because people who are meant to be the primary carers, who are meant to be there for their children at all costs, are the very people who in the end do things as diabolical as strapping them into a stroller, parking them in a closet and walking away to go on a date, knowing that that child is starving to death and dying over a period of days. This child deserves so much more. Let's hope that at least with us sharing this story and connecting with this name and knowing this child just a little bit more, that we allow her legacy to live on within us, that we allow ourselves to be brought into that light where we do risk offending, where we do say things that are challenging to people who need to hear it, and where we don't allow the silence of special needs to fall into a category where this kind of fatality occurs. Take care, guys. Look after yourself. And like I said, one of the things I'm acutely aware of is some of you have children with developmental delay and special needs and spectrum disorders. And I know how hard you work. I know what you do for your kids. And I know that in particular, this case will have horrified you. And you'll be looking at your own baby thinking, how? And the reality is, I pose the same question, how?
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.